Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugurpul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Nunakal, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the first peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners. Tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, public holiday here in Brisbane yesterday. It was nice to have a break. And the weather we're getting is just magical weather, beautiful weather. Blue sky and sunshine. And, of course, the Brisbane Exhibition people down there are I think they're getting record crowds. All going well. Now, my guest today is Heron Loban. Heron is a senior lecturer at the School of Law in JCU. And she's one of her specialist areas is consumer law and Indigenous people. Heron joins me on the telephone via telephone from Cairns. Heron, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, well, thank you. Good morning. Good morning.
And, of course, the weather's just beautiful in Cairns, I imagine.
It is. It is. It's a bit chilly in the evenings, but it's definitely warm and sunny in the days.
Yeah. All right. Heron, tell us a little about yourself. Who's your mob? Where's your country?
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm a Torres Strait Islander. So I was born on TI, Thursday Island, there in the Torres Strait. My family is from Mabiog in the Western Islands and also Boigu in the Western Islands too, which has been on the news recently for the immigration issues. But so we're very close there to Papua New Guinea. And I guess have been very lucky to have in my own family some good role models that have eventually led me to the law, which is, I guess, brings me to talking to you today. And so I'd just like to acknowledge my own elders, past and present, and also, you know, the traditional owners and the elders past and present amongst all our listeners and family as well.
Whereabouts did you grow up, go to school, on to uni?
Well, I grew up in Brisbane. I did all my school there, so primary school, high school, and then eventually I went to university. And for some reason, I don't know why, I had always decided I would be a lawyer. And so my first year at university, I went to law school, and I went to a university in Brisbane called the University of Queensland. And it was there that I studied my law degree and learnt all about the law and the legal system. And then have gone on to be a lawyer and now work as a law lecturer at university. Yeah, come full circle, I suppose.
All right. You said eventually you got to university. What was it, the need to work, the need to generate an income? What was it that you never went straight into university, decided to have a gap year or gap years?
I did end up going straight into university. I did work over that break between school and university, but I was lucky enough to have, I suppose, the support of my family and being able to live at home. So like, I was able to, yeah, be lucky enough to go into university from school.
All right, yeah. Studying law, blackfella studying law, and you look around and you see so many inconsistencies, so much wrong within the law and the justice system. How was it for you studying and knowing of the experiences of your own family, of friends, of just people generally across the country happen to be First Nations or Torres Strait Islander people? What was it like for you?
Yeah, look, to be honest, it was really hard. I remember there was just a handful of other you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students studying in the whole law school. So of hundreds and hundreds of students, I remember there were maybe three or four of us that were studying there together at different year levels. And Look, it was really hard because it's the law. It's very conservative, and really it doesn't acknowledge us as First Nations people, as Indigenous peoples of Australia, and so it's very strange to be studying at university and studying an area like law, which doesn't really acknowledge you as a person or as a group of people. And so, look, it was really difficult, and I really did use the Indigenous support unit, which they had at the university, where all the other Indigenous students studying other courses went, so that we could talk to each other and you could connect with, you know, other Torres Strait Islander students or Aboriginal students and talk about those challenges and the racist comments that might be said by students or even the lecturers, and how to manage that and how to help keep you on track. So it can be difficult, but it's not impossible if you look to the support, you know, of your community there in the university and your own family as well.
You've worked in a number of different areas, including Native Title. You've written a number of and co-authored a number of research papers and things like that. It is stated that your specialist area is consumer law and Indigenous people.
Yeah. Look, I have had a few different jobs before I've come to this job. I did work in Native Title. I worked in the Torres Strait on Thursday Island, so worked on land claims and also worked a little bit on the fee claim that just got decided by the High Court last week. So I've worked in Native Title. I also worked for a little while at the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service on Thursday Island as well, doing a bit of criminal law. So in my having those interests and working as a solicitor in those areas, when I've come to the university, I've continued with those interests in Native Title and criminal law. But I've also developed this new interest, which I think is an increasing one and an important one that isn't always thought about by people, and that's this area of consumer law or consumer protection, and whether the law is protecting Indigenous people enough under the current law and the current legal system that we have in Queensland and Australia. So that's really, I guess, an important and emerging interest that I've got now.
Mm. I see a good article in the Aboriginal Law Bulletin, I think it's a current publication, written by yourself about consumer law. What are some of the challenges for our mob, our people? What are some of the concerns for you?
Yeah, look, some of the I did write this sort of short article in the Indigenous Law Bulletin because I do have these concerns, and we see them these issues coming up in the cases that are going into court, in the federal court actually. And the two main issues that I've talked about in that article that come up in the cases time and time again, even over the past sort of 20 years, where you've got Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, is being able to access legal services or financial services in order to provide people with good advice and good information about what they should be buying, or what they should be, what telephone services they should be accessing, or what mobile phone they should be buying. But also the issue that when people make their decision, and if they do have a problem with their mobile phone, or if they do have a problem with something else that they buy or their mobile service, you know, a lot of people don't know who to complain to or what their legal rights are or what they can do about it. And those two issues come up again and again in all the cases. And so I think from my point of view, what it shows is that the law probably isn't enough, and there are some other strategies or programs that need to be considered to ensure that, you know, our people know what their rights are and can get good service and have access to good advice as well.
So the law, what can be done then? If the law isn't good enough, if it's not adequate or doesn't adequately cater to our mob, what are some of the things that are required? Because there's a range of things. There's not only mobile phones, which your article was specifically about, contracts where people... I'll get you to tell us that story, but it's not only to do with phones. There are cars. There are white goods. There's a range of areas where where our people are vulnerable. They're just an open target and for unscrupulous operators. And they're targeted year after year after year, I think your research would probably show.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. And look, it's I sort of recall this story that that first really, I guess, developed my interest and understanding of what an important issue this was, this consumer law and Indigenous people, is I was working at the legal service on Thursday Island on TI, and I had this woman come into my office, and she was distraught. She was so upset. She was crying, and she, you know, finding it very hard to sort of explain to me what it was that brought her to my office at the legal service. And what had happened is that she has a daughter who has a disability and is in a wheelchair, who's primary school age. And she'd come down to Cairns with her daughter and was looking for a car. And she needed a very particular type of car that was able to accommodate her daughter who had a disability, including, you know, her wheelchair that she needed to put at the back of the car. So she went, she picked a car, she did a test drive here in Cairns, and then she flew back to TI. She, at that time, she put a $15,000 deposit on this car, which is a lot of money, a cash deposit. And when she went back to TI, the car was due to be put on the boat and to go up to TI. And a few days later, the car dealer rang her and said, "Oh, look, that car that you picked and, you know, that you wanted to buy and you've left the deposit for, there's something wrong with it. So we're not going to sell it to you anymore. We're going to sell you a different car and we're going to put it on the boat tomorrow and it'll be there in a few days." So she was distraught because she was trying to be sold a car that she'd never seen, a car that she didn't want, and she had no way of physically going to the office to demand her money back, and she just didn't know what to do. So eventually we did have a good outcome. We got the regulator involved, so the government office that looks after that, they physically went to the car dealer, demanded the money be repaid, and a cheque was written out and given immediately when they were there. But I think what it really demonstrates is this, that it's so easy, even if you try to do all the right things, that you can be caught out by car dealers and unscrupulous dealers, as you say.
And one of the biggest issues is just not really knowing where to go, not really knowing what to do about it. You know it's wrong, but knowing where to go.
Exactly. And I guess that's where this woman had a great outcome. She came to the legal service. So I would say if people don't know where to go and they're not sure what to do, your Aboriginal legal service is a good starting point to try and get some initial advice. And that was what she did coming to see me. The other option is you can also contact the Government Department of Fair Trading. So they look after all these types of issues with cars, white goods, other products that you might buy as well. There's also an ombudsman called the Telecommunications Industry Ombudsman, and you can contact them. They've got a specific Indigenous section that deals with Indigenous complaints. So there really are a lot of different services that you can access before you actually, I guess, have to go to court, which is what these people eventually did. And that's important for people to know. And I guess because people don't know that, I always say the legal service is a good place to start for these types of issues.
Mm.
I guess the other people that can provide assistance are people we call financial counsellors. So they really help people with budgeting, but also managing any debts that you might have and managing your money. So financial counsellors, we now have quite a few Indigenous financial counsellors across Australia, including in Queensland, and they're at places like Uniting Care, or used to be Lifeline, places like Centre Care, and they can also help people who might be having issues with telephone or electricity or other debts or loans that you might have from places like payday lenders or credit cards. So there's definitely help out there. But as you say, the main people is people, issues. People don't know who those people are that can help. So hopefully we can improve that knowledge through, you know, interviews like this radio interview and through my paper as well that I published.
Mm. So your comment a few minutes back, consumer law is not, doesn't seem, isn't quite good enough. No more needs to be done. What do you, yeah. What do you think? How do you boost things or make, how do you make a difference? If the law's not good enough as it is, what can be done?
Yeah. Look, I think what can be done is that the government in particular that looks after the law and implements it through the courts and through other departments, I think really has to be more proactive. They really need to get out there into the community and make known what people's rights are, how people can protect themselves as well when they're buying something from a business or dealing with the business. We are seeing some changes in the government departments that have that responsibility starting to be more proactive. So, for example, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, they have done some films with some Tiwi Island people. And they're quite humorous, some of them. And you can get them online and you can get them on Facebook. And they're just short films with Tiwi Island people talking about Tiwi Island issues around consumer law and what people should do to exercise their rights. So I really think that the responsibility now is on government to make sure that they're doing their job and that they're really getting out there and educating the community and providing awareness programs of how people can make good decisions and also protect themselves from unscrupulous traders as well. So I think that's really where the main change needs to happen in within government.
I suppose the simplest and strongest message that could be put out there to our mob is, if you know things aren't right, look into it. There are places to go. There's somewhere or somebody that you can go to lodge a complaint. There are complaint, complaint processes, I suppose.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And, you know, I think, and we all know what it's like when sometimes you might get a bill and you know that it's for your phone or you know that it's for, you know, your credit card or you know that it's for a loan and you don't want to open that letter. So you just hide it somewhere and you hope that it goes away. But unfortunately, what happens is that those letters don't stop coming, and people, you know, those phone calls, sometimes the debt collectors ring you and those phone calls don't stop coming too. But what you can do is that you can get help with that. So we know that a lot of people don't like to make complaints, or that they feel a bit shame, or they feel a bit scared about what might happen. But look, it's really easy to contact someone at, for example, Lifeline, Uniting Care, or to contact the Indigenous Consumer Assistance Network that we have here in Cairns, or to contact, you know, your legal service and say, look, I have this problem. These are my, this is the paperwork that I've got. Or even if you don't have any paperwork, that's okay. And those people at the legal service or the financial counsellors can really advocate for you, and they can talk to the bank or they can talk to the telephone company or they can talk to the electricity company to help you with that and get some good outcomes. And so I would say that it can be hard to make a complaint, but there are people like financial counsellors and legal services that can help you through that process. And I suppose once you've done it once, then hopefully you gain that knowledge and information and confidence to make complaints later on again if you need to.
All right. Heron, let's take a break for a song and we'll be back in just a minute. My guest is Heron Loban. Heron is a senior lecturer at the School of Law in JCU, campus at Cairns, and she has a particular interest in consumer law and Indigenous people. And we'll get Heron to tell us about the couple of cases that she actually wrote about within the Aboriginal Law Bulletin about telephone companies, telcos, selling contracts to our mob. Where the damn service doesn't even work. The phone won't even work there. Heron, tell us about the telcos, the particular cases that you wrote about in the your article in the Law Bulletin.
Yeah, look, there have been a number of cases just over the past 5 years or so, which is actually might sound like a lot, but having a few cases go all the way to the federal court is actually it's actually a good number. So the cases that I wrote about, there were the first two cases actually involved the same company. So they involved this company called Viptel, and the reason that the regulator, the Australian Competition Consumer Commission, took this Viptel to court is that they were had a call centre overseas, and they were ringing people in Indigenous people in remote Indigenous communities, you know, telemarketing, cold calling them, and asking if they wanted to buy mobile phones and mobile phone plans. And a lot of people, you know, thought, oh, yep, this is a good idea. I need a new phone, or I'd like to have a new phone, or I need a second phone. And so, you know, signed up for the mobile phone plan. What happened, though, is that when the mobile phones arrived, and for people that sort of live up in remote Queensland know that only the Telstra network really is the one that works out in our communities. And it wasn't until people got their phones and they realised that there wasn't actually any coverage in the area in the phone plans that were sold by this company, and that the phones that they were sent didn't even actually work in the community that they lived in. So they had a phone that didn't work because there was no coverage or reception, and they had a plan that was no good because it was with the Optus network, and the Optus network hadn't yet extended to their community. And the court said, look, you know, you've told people that the phone's going to work in their community, and you've told people that the Optus network will work in their community, when in reality, if you had have checked, or if you had have made some inquiries, you would have known and should have told the person that in fact in their remote Indigenous community they don't have that network, and so you're selling them something that's totally useless, which is obviously against the law. So that was the first case.
Heron, how is this business done? Is it a telephone call? Obviously people aren't, it's not face-to-face out in their community, because the telcos would realise that there's no Optus service.
Exactly. It is all done by telephone. It's done by the overseas call centres, ringing people, usually on their home phone. So they might have a home phone within their house, and so the telemarketers overseas from the telephone company ring them at home, and then they try to sell them a mobile phone.
Now,
so that's how that happens. Yeah.
Now, could this not be a, I don't know, almost, I suppose, an honest mistake, where somebody sitting in the middle of Sri Lanka or wherever, I mean, most of them seem to be over in that part of the country, the world, these telemarketers, somebody sitting there, they don't know whether there's an Optus service, or do they, or should they, in Cape York communities, for example?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, that really is the question that the court looks at. And what the court says is that, well, you know, even if you are in Sri Lanka, or even if you are in India, if you're running a company in Australia that wants to sell phones and phone services to people living in Australia, then you need to know what services are available and what services you can actually sell. And so there's a very clear responsibility that the law and the court says that if you're going to be that business, you need to know what services are available, and you need to make inquiries to make sure that you know what services you can give. And if you don't make those inquiries, and if you tell people that they can have a service when you haven't checked whether they can or not, then you're actually being dishonest, you're misleading people, you're misrepresenting the truth, and that is obviously, you know, against the law. And that's what the court said, is that that's what businesses need to do, and if they don't do that, well, then they're actually behaving in a dishonest kind of way.
Mm. What sort of pressure and trauma must it cause for some of our mob that might be Arakoon or any one of those communities, particularly in Cape York, that are quite vulnerable for this, and where there is only a Telstra service? I think it's still the case, isn't it? Is Optus not in there yet? It's still just Telstra?
No, yeah, it's still just Telstra there at the moment. Yeah, not yet.
So what sort of trauma and stress and that does it... The people get the phone in the mail, I imagine. They're trying to get it working. And generally, you call back to the damn call centre where you can barely understand what they're talking, like the language, their accent and stuff like this. I mean, this must be quite traumatic for a lot of our mob.
Yeah, look, and you're right. And it's and that question of language and communication comes up time and time again where people say, look, I don't understand their accent. If it's an Indian person, you know, an Aboriginal person says from Cape, says, I don't understand their accent, so I can't, you know, hear what they're saying to me. But look, in talking to people, as I have done over the past few years, it really is traumatic. It has a devastating effect, it can do, on people's families because there's a debt that you get because this phone service doesn't work, but you still get calls and people chasing you for the money, or you might have paid some money up front. And that's money that people need to provide for their families and for their households. And it creates a lot of stress, not just not having money because you've paid for a service that doesn't work, but also the constant harassment as well. Really creates a lot of stress and affects people's mental health and well-being, and that can have flow-on effects. Even situations such as domestic violence and alcohol and drug abuse have been linked to financial stress caused by these kind of situations where people have been ripped off by unscrupulous businesses. So it really can have a significant effect on individuals and their families.
In mainstream Australia, since colonisation, maybe just in the last 100 years, but there have been numerous cases in mainstream Australia of people taking their own lives because they found, I'm talking about mainstream whitefella, taking their own lives because they don't see any way out of their debt or the circumstances that they're in. So it's only common sense that it's going to affect First Nations people in the same way, where there is trauma and stress in trying to deal with these situations.
Yeah, absolutely. And people have told me that firsthand. You know, they've tried to... I remember one couple had told me that they had bought a car from Brisbane, that they're in up here this way, far north Queensland, in a remote community. They bought a car, and when they got the car, all these things started to break down. And the reason that they bought the car is they wanted to take their sons out of community on the weekends to go camping, you know, to teach them, you know, traditional hunting and traditional
the culture, country.
To teach them culture.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening is that car broke down, so they couldn't do that. But more than that, the stress of the bills, of the harassment from the car company, and having this great debt and not knowing what to do with it actually caused the family to break up.
Yeah.
And then the parents separated. And they were, I spoke to them both and they said, you know, this was just because of this loan and this car and being ripped off by this company.
Mm.
You know, and that can't be allowed to happen. Mm. And that's, I guess, highlights the importance of people knowing what their rights are and getting in early so that it doesn't just, you know, get to that point in families. Yeah.
One of these telcos actually put together a bodgy debt collecting service and what have you, I think I recall reading.
Yeah, look, they did. It was unbelievable, really. Cheeky, all right. It was actually this Excite Mobile company. So I don't know if people have heard of Excite Mobile, but this was a case that was just decided this year. And so they sold people, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in remote communities, phones and plans that didn't work because there was no service. And then where people rang up to complain about the fact that their phone didn't work and they didn't have a service because there was no reception, then they referred them to this, bodgy, made-up complaints body that was actually part of the same company. And so people would go there and then they try and complain, but really it was just the same company trying to stop people from making complaints to the real complaints body. And then more than that, they also then created this other part of the company that pretended to be a debt collector, be another business that was collecting the debt on behalf of the company. But it was actually the same company selling the plans, then taking complaints, and then writing these really bizarre letters to people from the debt collectors, saying that their lawyers were tenacious, and there was things like they were like bulldogs, I think it was, and they'll get you, and they'll get you in court, and really strange letters. But some people responded to the letters and paid the money, which is what happens.
That's right.
People break the law, but then people don't know their rights, and so they just do it thinking that that's what they should do, when in fact they don't have to. So is this
the company that actually went into receivership? I mean, tell us the outcomes. What happened in this regard?
Yeah, so look, the outcome with Excite is that, no, they're still operating according to the case. It was actually the Viptel company. They went into liquidation. But the second company, Excite Mobile, is still operating as far as I'm aware. But, of course, what happens is people have all their contracts cancelled. They're entitled to refunds, which is a good thing. And I guess the important thing that the Excite Mobile case highlighted as well is that in that case, important key evidence was provided by the Central Australian Aboriginal Legal Service. So it means that people in Alice Springs or in Central Australia did actually go to their Aboriginal Legal Service to get help, and that actually resulted in, you know, this outcome. And also another Indigenous organisation here in Cairns as well helped provide that evidence. So eventually all the contracts were cancelled and people were entitled to a refund, which is obviously, you know, a great outcome. But if you can avoid that in the first place, all the better.
Most certainly. Is there a fine imposed? Is it a substantial fine? Is it just a slap over the wrist? What is the penalty in the case like this?
Yeah, look, the court, because we've had a few of these cases now come before the court's getting sick of seeing these cases and getting sick of companies trying to take advantage of people and trying to get away with breaking the law. So we've seen the fines slowly increase over time, and I think the fines are now in the millions of dollars, that the court is wanting to send a very clear message to mobile phone companies that you need to act in good faith and honestly and provide information that is true and correct. And if you don't do that, then you're going to get a fine of $1-2 million because of that behaviour. So that's a good thing, that the court's trying to send a strong message, and the fines are getting higher and higher as each case comes before the court because the court's sick of it and doesn't want to see it anymore.
Hmm. What was the story of the company that actually went into receivership, and how does that affect things? I mean, you've got a number of people that that maybe the decision is they get refunds and what have you, but then the company's gone into receivership.
That's right. I mean, unfortunately, with the Viptel phone company, they went to court once and they weren't deterred. They didn't learn their lesson, I suppose. And then they went to court a second time doing the same thing. But by that time, the court, being taken to court for doing the wrong thing, cost them a lot of money. So they did go into receivership. They went into liquidation. And so whilst it's good in that company doesn't exist anymore and can't sell those phone plans or those mobile phones to Indigenous people and communities that don't work, what it does mean is that a lot of those people would not have got their refund, that the money wouldn't have been there, it would have already been spent on legal fees or on other things by the company. And so unfortunately in that case, the Indigenous consumers would not have all been able to get their refunds for the money that they spent, which could have been a small amount of money, like $100, or it could have been, you know, $2,000 or $3,000. So sometimes even going to court doesn't deliver justice in that you don't get the outcome that's really, should be fair for the Indigenous consumer.
All right. Is there anything else you want to tell us about consumer affairs or this situation with our mob, where they're vulnerable, they're just targets for unscrupulous dealers?
Yeah, look, it's true. I guess the good thing is, and I think the thing that's positive, and I always think it's important to sort of be positive and think about, you know, what can we do and how can we empower ourselves and our communities, is that we are seeing more, we are seeing government being more proactive in community education programs, you know, being on Facebook, doing films. We are seeing more Indigenous financial counsellors as well in Anglicare and Uniting Care and Centrecare that are specifically able to provide, you know, consumer help services to Indigenous people. And we're also seeing other organisations like the Telecommunications Industry Ombudsman taking, you know, a real interest in trying to improve the access to services and complaints processes for Indigenous people. So I guess I would just really encourage people that if they haven't, if they've got an issue, and you know, if you're feeling stressed about it and you feel like it's not right, then it probably isn't. So go and get some help, because there's a lot of help out there, and you know, you could get a refund, you could get the contract cancelled, and there's a whole lot of good outcomes that can come of that. So you know, so take those steps, and you can and exercise your legal rights, I suppose.
All right. Well, Hiran, thanks for joining us today. It's great to talk to you.
And, yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You keep up the great work. We may well call on you again some stage for a discussion.
Yep, thank you. Happy to talk again.
All right. Have a good day.
All right, thank you. Bye. All right, yawo.
Hiran Loban joining me. And Hiran is a senior lecturer at the School of Law at James Cook University, Cairns campus. Tomorrow's guest is Marilyn Haynes from Queenslanders for Safe Water. We're talking about fluoridation. Yes, the dreaded fluoridation, fluoridating our water. So make sure you join us tomorrow.